Good evening. I'm Heather Brown, and it's time again for Between the Covers. Tonight, we're starting a beautiful quartet of tales about love and loss. They're by Kingston writer Stephen Hyten. In these interlocking stories about relationships, he explores how we do or do not notice what is happening to us at important moments in our lives. The overall title of these linked tales is To Everything a Season. These stories trace the relationships of three generations in an Ontario family. They also follow the seasons, starting tonight with Winter Earth.
How does it happen for the last time? The lovemaking. Two bodies joined once, twice, 1,000 times, then never again. How? Over the city, a vault of winter clouds as gray and cold as limestone. Like the walls of the old house, the walls of the garden, where the raised beds of frozen earth pushed through snow like islands in an ice-bound lake. Through a circle he had cleared in the frost of his study window, Alden looked out across the garden and over ranks of snowy roofs to the lake, where the ferry was crossing to Wolf Island. At this distance it seemed to glide above the ice, and only the mist rising around it from a slim, tenuous lead of open water proved otherwise. The newspaper, open on his desk, advised commuters that tonight the channel would freeze hard in the few hours the ferry docked. From tomorrow until the lake warmed in early March, the much longer winter route would be used. Perfect, yes. And those scales, the ones in D minor, you won't forget. So next week at the same time? Holly dismissing her last student downstairs, playing her own voice with virtuoso skill, touching all the lively, pert, high, trilling notes. Alden? Alden? Her own voice again, weary and dissonant, tuned back to the cracked, muffled chords of old age by the departure of outsiders, the front door's slam. Alden got up from his hard chair and stood facing his great-great-grandfather Caleb MacLeod, the rebel and exile, who glowered out of his framed old charcoal sketch as if from a prison casement. Chastened, Alden pocketed his glasses, crossed the small, dim study, and pulled open the door. The glassed-in parchment map on the back rattled softly as the door swung to. Alden's study was papered in maps, ancient, old, or recent. The former tools and current mementos of 36 years in the geography department at the college. Alden had been, and in retirement remained, an authority on historical cartography, especially as it applied to the mapping of southeastern Ontario and the Thousand Islands. The Garden of the Spirits, the Iroquois had called it. The Garden of the Gods, before they and their names were written over or erased. After Holly's Sunday afternoon lessons, a blessed silence settled over the house. After 18 years with his own children at home and many more among the swelling undergraduate hordes, Alden had been ready for retirement, for the cozy, undemanding silence and setness of the old limestone house, for a study untrespassed by students who sprang lately from a world for which he had no maps, and which continued to spawn junior colleagues of an increasingly remote and radical stripe. Post-colonial revisionings of the mapping process. Marxist demography. The cartographer as rapist. He had always been more comfortable with maps than people anyway. Alden! He started downstairs. Holly had taken on the piano students soon after Caleb and Annie left home. Within a year, one after another, the house suddenly silent after all that time. She had said the students were to give her something to do besides the garden and her winter reading, and he had seen her point. It was good for her to get out of the house and to meet new people. But in the last few years, her back problems had worsened, and her students had begun to come to her, and inescapably, to him. He could hardly object, out loud, to such a necessity. She was waiting for him at the dining room table. He sat down across from her and heard the kettle steaming in the kitchen. Snow fell behind her, beyond the picture window giving onto the garden, and it seemed to fall around and onto her head, whitening her hair, which grew whiter each year, so her shrinking face seemed each year redder against the white, her blue eyes refined to an eerie brilliance. "Really, Alden, there's no need for you to hide away in your study whenever they come. Or look at me like that. I was watching the snow. Behind you," he said. She half turned in her chair and winced, her rouged mouth pinched and puckering. Alden started to his feet and then, seeing she was all right, settled back down. She said, "I would have thought it was too cold to snow." "Well, the paper predicts the ferry channel will freeze tonight and they'll have to change to the winter route tomorrow. So tonight would be better for the island." "Yes." "Is your back too painful? Well, we don't have to go." "Alden, please." That faint, exasperated quaver betraying deep weariness. A yellowing key accidentally touched on a worn old piano. "I only meant..." "No," she said. "I want to. We go every New Year and we'll go tonight. I want to." "Well, I realize the food isn't as good as it used to be." She smiled. "That's us. We don't taste things the same way." She started to get up for the kettle, but he waved her off with a brisk, teacherly sweep of the hand. "To hear you talk," he chided from the kitchen, "you'd think we were in our 80s. He poured a stream of boiling water into the white stoneware pot she had already sprinkled with leaves. He checked his watch. Beyond the kitchen window, snow sifted into the garden, filling the furrows between the raised beds. Tucked invisibly under the sill, the stiff, frozen stalks and clenched, faded flowers of the snapdragons would be sinking under the snow. As he served her, Holly frowned and fidgeted with the brooch pinned on her thin breast, the gray cardigan that grew looser by the week. How much longer, he wondered, would she be able to go on teaching? He did wish she could still go out to do it. They drank tea in silence. The room went darker, the clean corners growing dusty with shadow, and the dust seemed to creep outward and suffuse the whole room. He squinted again at his watch. "Shall we get ready?" She swallowed the last of her tea as if bracing for an ordeal. "You really don't want to go," he told her, sensing her fatigue and how it mirrored his own and accusing her of both. But her back, he thought, her spine, the bones there dissolving. A woman who had loved more than anything else to go out for dinner, for walks, for drinks and dancing. Each New Year, as they got ready for the drive to the ferry and the island for their annual celebration, she would grow spry, sprightly as Caleb and Annie years before at Christmas. The drive down Princess Street, crowded with students under the green and spruce blue lights, and then aboard the ferry, pulling out, the half-hour passage with the boat grinding through the ice-clogged channel, or taking the longer route past Fort Henry, and the lights of Marysville to the winter dock. Then a short drive to the old limestone inn, the Sir John A., and the table they reserved each year by the window, with the city lights mirrored in long, tapering rays over the ice. He helped her upstairs, and in their bedroom turned on the dim lamp on the oak table between the beds. Her idea, these matching single beds. Not long after his retirement, she had pointed them out in a catalog and said that with her waking at night for pills, it might be better for him. He might rest a bit better. "Well," he'd said after a time, a short time during which his mind flashed over a broad, somber spectrum of feelings, "I suppose it's a good idea. It would be better for you, I suppose, your back." And he'd added, "Besides, we never really make love anymore." "We never much did," she'd snapped. And after all, there had been a time when only he wasn't different. Once the children were born and his academic standing and responsibilities increased, when sex had seemed, as often as not, just too much fuss. He wondered sometimes if he had left his most passionate efforts in the lecture hall or perhaps at his desk. He could not be sure. He couldn't say. He could only wonder how a man put in 35 years at an esteemed institution of higher learning, reading and thinking and teaching, and 41 years in the institution of marriage, perfectly faithful, in marked contrast to his colleagues, or most of them, how it happened He raised 2 good children and cared for his wife in health and now in sickness and did everything one is supposed to do, only to end up so baffled, bled dry, alone in a study scanning the legends of priceless old parchment maps for a clue to where he was and what had happened. One of the country's foremost authorities on, the author of respected volumes concerning lies on one level, a stranger to his most basic desires. He eased shut the bathroom door and shaved for the 2nd time that day. The light above the mirror granted, as usual, no quarter at all. His dull eyes trapped in a cobweb of wrinkles, deep shadow in the wattled folds of his neck. But a full head of silver hair swept off the forehead and back from the sides, still handsome. When he stepped back into the bedroom, the lamp was off, the room almost dark. Holly sat on the side of her quilt, knees in the furrow between the beds, her knees bare. She was naked. They always undressed separately these days, not exactly hiding from each other, but with a kind of coy Victorian stealth, discreet contortions and turnings away, Holly stiffer, more clumsy all the time, Alden more precise and methodical. It had been a while since he'd seen her naked, thinner now, sitting on her bedside in the near dark. Alden? Faint stirrings, a quickening in the belly. Not the rushing spring melt of early youth, but an echo of that, muted as so many things now seemed, as if age were gradually cooling, burying him in drifts of softly falling, what? Not only snow, checks and bills? A storm, maybe, of calendar leaves blown from the old black-and-white films of his youth. Blurring his eyes, frosting his brows and hair, his ears filling up, his senses shrouded, deadened, but alive. He undressed. Snow slipped past the darkening window, and for a moment a gust rattled the pane, and snow whirled and flocked against it. "Of course I want to go," she said softly as he eased down beside her. "I still look forward to it, every year. Here, kiss me." Her face looked different, smoothed out by the near dark. In bright light, her papery skin seemed almost translucent, as if she were melting from outside as well as from within. But this dimness filled out and deepened her face, so she seemed now more solid, substantial, less likely to fold up and crumple if he held her. And as they lay back together on her bed and began again, with great patience, for the first time in a year, and the 2nd in 3 years, and for the last time, a thought drifted through Alden's mind, and he wondered if it mattered, and thought it must, but then he lost it. He let it go, and only recalled later, when they arrived an hour late at the Sir John A, that he'd been worried about missing the next ferry. Their pale bodies stirring, like snow outside the window, blending, settling through gray air, then churned to life by occasional gusts, and floating down again to sift white over the frozen earth like seed, but cold. And as Alden made slow and difficult, blissful love to Holly, he wondered why they had never much done it, and why they did not do it more often now, in spite of everything, to let it heal and bind them. And he vowed he would not let the intensity and purity of this moment melt away. He would keep it alive inside him. He would make this happen more often again. But afterward, as they lay on her bed, he felt the warmth and rapture begin to fade and bleed away. Stored heat drawn from the body of the earth as summer ends, and autumn, and ice embalms the dead stalks of flowers and glazes over the lake. So they came home later that night from the island to their separate beds and went on as before. And Alden failed to keep his vow, and kept on asking himself, how and why? How was it that the love and gravity stored in the lodestones of the body, the organs, and the brain were strong enough one day to draw 2 people together, and the next day, not quite strong enough, or the next, a threshold crossed, the body's brief half-life ending. He holds her arm tightly as they come downstairs, he in a wool suit, dark gray, she in a pleated maroon skirt and jacket. Telling her he wants to clear snow from the steps, he carefully bundles up and hurries out around the house for a shovel. The air is clear and cold. Orion's belt hangs over the chimney like three sparks, and in the back garden, light from the picture window maps a gold square on the beds of soil. A faint, high trilling of music. Through the dining room window, Alden sees Holly at the piano, hunched painfully over the keyboard, her face flushed and her lips half open, budding into a smile. He can't quite make out the piece she's playing, but he stands a long time leaning on his shovel in that parcel of light and watches.
That was Robert Boxtall reading from To Everything a Season. It's from Stephen Hyten's collection, On Earth as It Is. Tomorrow night, we take the road with Caleb's son. Our poetry nightcap is about maps and a young boy's imagination. The Edmonton poet Nigel D'Arbese was born and raised in Trinidad. In his poem, A Map of the Island, there's a big difference between his youthful experience of his homeland and what he learns about it in geography class. It's read by Damon D'Olivera.
A Map of the Island. At school, on a map of the world, the teacher showed us home. Little more than a speck off Venezuela, almost touching the South American coast. Then we looked at a large map of Trinidad and saw mountain ranges, long rivers, the cities of Port of Spain and San Fernando, villages and towns where nobody in class had been. We knew that maps were deceiving. A distance of inches down a squiggly red line amounted to a long drive by car. Enough time in which the land, the people, even the air would change and you'd be someplace different. The teacher said that we lived on an island, but we already had proof. It was more like a vast country where worlds lay enfolded within worlds.
Damon D'Olivera reading Nigel D'Arbese's poem, A Map of the Island. It's the title poem from his collection, A Map of the Island, published by the University of Alberta Press. And that's our program for this evening. If you'd like to write to us, we can be reached at Between the Covers, P.O. Box 4600, Vancouver, B.C., V6B4A2. Our email address is btc@vancouver.cbc.ca. Stay tuned now for the CBC Radio 1 News, followed by late night music from Winnipeg on Northern Lights. Thank you.